This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. The year has changed, but the opening has not. I'm here with Kerry Kasem, my wonderful co-host, finally getting to see you. Happy New Year, Kerry.
Happy New Year. I know, I think you had a happy Hanukkah too. Watched your pictures and saw everything on social media.
So I haven't seen you in like 3 weeks?
Pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah. Long time.
Where have you been?
I was in Florida. I was in Barbados, St. Lucia, Dominica. I said it wrong. Dominica.
What are you doing? Why are you?
I just took a little cruise, you know? I just wanted to do something different and fun, and I had a blast.
It was fun?
It was a blast. I mean, every day we were either wakeboarding, snorkeling, swimming.
I saw a picture of you in a waterfall or something, and
yes.
I saw the back of you. You really had a sexy back in that picture.
Oh, thanks. I'm about, I think, a millimeter. In that, like a tiny, tiny,
it was
tiny
such
little picture.
A sexy back.
You couldn't even see my back, but thank you very much.
And you were slipping into a hot springs or something?
So what it is a waterfall and a pool, and it looks like something out of the Blue Lagoon. It looks like something off of a movie set.
Yeah, I thought you were Brooke Shields.
Yeah, I wish. But yeah, so
it's Have you seen her lately?
I haven't seen her lately,
okay,
no.
Don't wish.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah. In the Blue Lagoon, she was gorgeous. So it's a tiny, tiny little island with 70,000 inhabitants. And they have it's like dense rainforest. So it was destroyed 2 years ago by hurricanes. So I guess what we've seen now, the vegetation's growing back, but nothing compared to what it was. It used to have a whole canopy of trees. So you couldn't even see the sky. So it was like this buried little cave waterfall. Mm. It's still unbelievably gorgeous.
Yeah,
and the
it was.
Water was cool, not cold, so you could swim in it.
I'm so glad, though, that they didn't have those trees, not because of the natural disaster, but we were able to see your back because there weren't trees.
Oh, you know, you couldn't see my back.
The trees were not covering you, not at all.
If anybody is listening,
Kerry,
well, you know why? The Golden Globes are on.
If anyone's listening, football's over.
The Golden Globes are on right
Football
now.
Football is over. Today and was a huge, huge win for my team, the Minnesota Vikings. I'm very happy today. Overtime win. They flipped the coin and the Vikings got the ball and went down the field and beat the hapless New Orleans Saints. So yeah, you don't care, but anyway, I do.
I'm happy for you.
I'm wearing a Vikings sweatshirt, a Vikings hat. I got a Vikings shirt underneath.
Oh my gosh!
And of course, the Vikings socks.
You literally go crazy with sports.
And I have Vikings underwear, but I didn't wear it today because last time I wore it, they didn't win. So I've decided I might retire my
You're
Vikings underwear.
You're one of those
underwear.
Crazy people. Like if you wear the hat and they win, you have to wear the hat again. Until they
I'm
lose.
I'm really embarrassed to tell you what happened today because they were winning and I was sitting enjoying the game and then Hudson and Harper are playing football, flag football.
Okay.
Harper wanted to play and I didn't want to stand in between her. She's a little girl. She's going to be 6 years old and she wanted desperately to play on Hudson's team and a little bit of a controversy because we registered her and she came out to play and you know the coach wasn't exactly thrilled about it, thinking that she might get hurt.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. She could.
But I argued that, hey, you know, girls and boys, there's no prohibition. This is not a Supreme Court case where it says that only boys can play. Apparently, there's a constitutional right for a little girl to play flag football. And so she wanted to play. I didn't want to deprive her of it, being an equal opportunity father. So
what
they
happened?
Both played. Well, you know, me and the coach, who I'm very good friends with, and a fellow lawyer in workers' compensation happens to be in, and we're very good friends. And I got into it with him because You know, I wanted to protect my little girl, and I wanted to pursue, you know, women's rights and girls' rights to play with the boys.
Yeah, I don't agree with you, but that's okay. That's okay. That's why we do the show.
Maybe she'll be let go next week, and I'll have a Supreme Court case, because that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Yes,
Supreme Court cases. But anyway, while I was watching the game, the New Orleans Saints came back, and I was changing to go watch the football game where my kids were playing. And I actually, and I can't believe I'm admitting this, when the New Orleans Saints scored a touchdown, I actually went and changed back into the clothes that I had been wearing while the Vikings were winning.
I had a boyfriend like that once. And he would cry if the 49ers didn't win or if his Canucks didn't win. And it was like depression.
Yeah.
And real serious depression.
The only reason that I'm not depressed is because they did win.
Yeah.
And next week against the San Francisco 49ers, hoping to go there to see the game, but I'll see. Anyway, we need to talk about Supreme Court cases. And the two who we have on with us, the two scholars, the preeminent constitutional scholars, and we're very fortunate, folks, because it's not often that a show will have two of the top constitutional law scholars in the country debating each other. They both are very accomplished. Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of Berkeley Law, and Professor Michael McConnell is a professor at Stanford. He's the director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center, and he served in the United States Circuit Judge, 10th Circuit, Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals. And are they on the line? Are we ready to talk to them? I'm looking at Dino. We're so happy to have Dino back with
us. Dino's back.
He's back. I'm looking at his back. Thank you, Dino. We're excited to have you join the show again. He's been off and on with Gervie's Law for several years, but apparently he's, you know, watching sports as he always does. So we're going to need to take a break. But when we come back, Harry, it should be an interesting debate. I think the last time the two of them were on, Professor McConnell said to Professor Chemerinsky,
what planet are you on,
Erwin? So we're going to see if we're going to get any of those comments. You don't want to miss it. This is our Supreme Court cases rundown for 2020. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. And
we're back.
We're back because there's no one in the booth. We're going to break.
We're not going to do that to Wayman.
Where is Wayman?
He ran out and we're taking an early break. We're like 4 minutes early.
It doesn't matter.
I know, but we honestly, I have to say.
Wow.
No, I'm already getting texts that our callers are calling in.
Their callers are calling in.
Our callers. Erwin's on the line. I see him now.
Dino, can you find Wayman? We want to talk to Professor Chemerinsky and Professor McConnell.
Yes.
And he is absent. Not there.
But I have a question for you. This is the most serious thing.
Yes.
Who do you want to win the picture of the year for the Golden Globe?
You know,
do you remember when we used to do these?
I do remember. We didn't do them for the Golden Globes, but we did them for the
Oscars.
Oscars.
But remember, we did talk about the Golden Globes. They said it kind of foreshadows or foresees, like in the future, what's going to win in the Oscars.
Yeah, it does. It's very true. We'll do that another day. Today is Supreme Court Day. We need to hear about these cases with Professor Chemerinsky and Professor Michael McConnell. We're going to take a break. Wayman's back.
He's back.
He's on the phone. He's back. He's back. Calling. Who's he calling? Wayman, who are you on the phone with? No one of consequence. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposures, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner. If you're suffering from a work-related injury, Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now, 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Clear thinking. Free discussion. AM 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
All right, we're back. I thought this was the beginning of some Christmas music, but it isn't.
Not really.
Good. I hope not. Because we're in 2020, we need to turn our attention away from holidays and into some serious stuff. And what better way to start the year than reviewing the cases that the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, will be hearing this year. And we have two of the finest constitutional law scholars in the country. What a way to start the year. Preeminent constitutional law scholars. The Dean of Berkeley Law. He joined the faculty as the Jesse Choper Distinguished Professor of Law. And he's the founding Dean and Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California Irvine School of Law, which he left in 2017. Before that, he was at Duke University. He's the author of 11 books, over 200 law reviews. He writes a regular column for the Sacramento Bee and monthly columns for the ABA Journal and Daily Journal. In 2017, he was named the most influential person in legal education in the United States by National Jurist Magazine, the same place that said he's one of 23 law professors you just have to have before you die. Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, welcome back to Gervey's Law.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
And we are delighted to have you, and we are also very delighted to have Professor Michael McConnell, who served as the United States Circuit Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit from 2002 to 2009. Since 2009, he served as professor and director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center at Stanford University. He's a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institute. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. He was also a professor there. He's authored many legal articles and edited several books. He's often mentioned in the past as a Supreme Court nominee himself, and he's the author of significant opinions on the 10th Court, Court of Appeals, 10th Circuit, still very influential in the world today. From those decisions, Professor Michael McConnell, welcome back to Gervey's Law.
Thank you. Good to be here. My first time, though.
No, you've been with us, believe
yes,
it or not.
You were.
We have a famous quote you were on several years ago with Professor Chemerinsky and Professor Amir from Yale University. And your famous quote goes down into the annals when you said to Erwin Chemerinsky, "Erwin, what planet are you on?
Are you on?
I should have remembered that. Yes.
Well, we did, because I think the listeners really enjoyed the friendly debate between the rival law schools. At the time, Professor Chemerinsky was with UCI, now at Berkeley Law, and of course, you're still at Stanford. And I want to take this opportunity to run down some of the cases that the Supreme Court will be hearing. And I thought last time, when we've done this, we run out of time, and I don't want to miss out on what the two of you think are the most important cases. I'm going to allow each one of you to choose what you think is the most important case, and I think they're going to be different. There's so many options to think about. We've got the New York City gun rule that has some interesting issues. The Montana case, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. That's the religious schools funding case. June Medical Services, LLC versus GEE, which is the abortion case, if you want to call it an abortion case. Trump's financial records, dispute over termination of DACA, federal employment discrimination, employment for LGBT employees, Google versus Oracle in the ministerial exemption case, St. James School case, and Our Lady of Guadalupe School. Those are just a few that may be your favorite. So we need you each to choose one. And how we're going to do this is I need to flip a coin because one of you needs to go first to choose your favorite case. And because I was watching football today and I watched the overtime between the Minnesota Vikings and the New Orleans Saints, they flipped the coin to see who got the ball. Vikings got the ball, scored a touchdown. I'm going to flip a coin now.
Well, and how about if instead, I interrupt and say the most important case is the one that Erwin argued earlier this year.
Well, I thought he was going to say that case.
Oh, no. He's too modest for that.
Wow. That's amazing. This is real sportsmanship.
Maybe we don't have a coin toss.
I don't even need to do a coin toss. Professor McConnell, lead it off. Let's do it. Let's do the Chemerinsky argued case. Tell us about it.
Well, I guess I would not have picked it as the most important case, but I can then pick the one that I think that Michael is going to be arguing. I think you're going to be arguing the Governor Delaware versus Adams case, if I'm right. Is that correct, Michael?
That's right. So okay. that case is about Delaware's unique provision that its courts must be equally balanced between appointees belonging to the two political parties. Mm-hmm. So it's about political balance on the judiciary, and the lower court held that those restrictions are unconstitutional. I'm defending them.
And, Irwin, tell us your thoughts on that.
I think it's a fascinating case because, on the one hand, you can say it's political party discrimination to keep people from being able to be chosen just because they don't have the right affiliation or any political party affiliation. On the other is, this is very similar to the proposal that Pete Buttigieg has made for the United States Supreme Court, where we know that the values of the justices matter, and what Delaware is trying to do is to make sure that both sides are represented. If you want my prediction, and predictions are free and worth what they cost, I think Michael's going to win. I think it is a matter of political party discrimination and violates the First Amendment.
And I know we, in the past, have had Professor Brian Leiter on, who from Chicago, University of Chicago, and he's talked about the courts, especially the Supreme Court, just being a political organization based on political appointments, saying that it doesn't necessarily represent what the legal scholars of the world should really consider to be behind the laws. How does that come into play?
I don't think that's a fair characterization. In one sense, the Supreme Court isn't political in the way in which we think of legislatures being political. Anyone can go and lobby a city council member, a state legislator, a member of Congress. No one goes and lobbies Supreme Court justices. We find it completely acceptable that members of a city council or a legislature trade votes with one another. We've never heard of that and be outraged if it happened on the Supreme Court. The way in which the court is political is that it is about the ideology and values of the justices in many cases. And no, it's not a scholarly body in the sense that if you had a group of law professors together, but it's not meant to be. Law professors get to debate issues in a much more academic way. The justices have to decide cases.
Professor McConnell, would you agree with that?
Well, mostly, but I think the point here is that when any body, whether it's a court or a law school faculty, is overwhelmingly composed of people of only one point of view, I think it tends to go off the rails. It tends not to be reflective and scholarly. And I think the fact that the courts, for the most part, are closely divided is a great benefit to the country. And in some ways, I trust them more than I do law schools, which are overwhelmingly democratic.
Professor Chemerinsky, tell us your experience briefly, if you can, when you were becoming the distinguished professor of law over at UCI. Wasn't there some controversy with the chancellor, the president, having concerns about you and your perspectives?
There was, though thankfully this was a long time ago. It was in 2007 when it was announced that I was going to be the founding dean of the law school. Some conservatives in Orange County decided that I was too liberal, and the chancellor decided to withdraw the offer. There was then a loud protest against that by both liberals and conservatives, and the chancellor very quickly said he made a mistake. He flew out to North Carolina, where I was living, and offered me the position, which I accepted. And as I say, from my perspective, it's all ancient history.
All right.
So it's so important because Irwin is right that he was supported by conservatives as well as liberals on this. This is, which I think shows the system working. It's when the two sides become so partisan that they don't defend the proper interests of the other side that we really are in trouble.
Well, we don't see that with Professor Fink over at UCLA, who was let go for all these different reasons except what it was, and that's because he was a conservative. So we don't see that everywhere. In this case, it turned out all right. But why do we have, why is it that all the universities, the law schools, it seems to go left? What's going on with that?
I won't accept that characterization. I think that there are some law schools that have a predominantly conservative faculty. I think there are some that have a predominantly liberal faculty. On our faculty, we certainly have some notable conservatives. I think of John Yoo as an example, Orrin Kerr is fairly conservative. There's many on our faculty who I have no idea what their ideology is. So I just don't accept the characterization that the academy is overwhelmingly liberal. And let's face it, at this moment in time, we have a very conservative president, a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, a conservative majority in the Senate. I can't accept that conservatives are a beleaguered minority in our society.
Professor McConnell, last word on the Delaware case. Where's it going to go? What's going to happen?
Well, I'm certainly hoping that the court will uphold the law. But Delaware courts are extremely important to the commercial life of this country. Most large corporations charter in Delaware,
right,
partly because the judicial system can be counted upon to issue nonpartisan, objective, stable judgments. And I hope that the Supreme Court doesn't screw that up.
All right. Before you pick your case, Professor Chemerinsky, and as you've said, the case that you argued is not what you think is the most important case. Tell us a little bit about the case you argued and what that experience was like, and then I want you to segue into what the most important case is from
sure.
your perspective.
The case I argued is Comcast versus the National Association of African-Owned Media. I argued it on November 13th. It involves a very important federal civil rights statute, 42 United States Code, Section 1981. It was adopted as part of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and it prohibits race discrimination in contracting. My client is Byron Allen. He owns many cable channels. Comcast refused to contract with him. They told him there were many things he needed to do. He did them all, and they still wouldn't contract with him. They said that they didn't have any bandwidth, but they then contracted with over 60 white-owned channels. Something very racist was said to him, and so he sued under this. And the question is it enough to allege that race was a motivating factor in the denial of contract, or does he have to allege that race was the so-called but-for causation, the essentially sole reason for denying the contract? And my position, of course, is, and it was the position in the Ninth Circuit, it should be enough to allege that race is a motivating factor. Comcast says it should be a much more stringent standard in order to get into court in order to win.
Professor McConnell, your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know the details of Irwin's case, but I do think there are three possibilities, not just two. There's race could be a motivating factor, it can be the motivating factor, but I think in most discrimination contexts, the standard is whether the decision, a different decision, would have been reached but for the discriminatory factor. And I don't know how that plays out for Irwin's client.
And Irwin, tell us about what's going to happen in the Delaware case in your crystal ball.
Oh, I'm going to predict that Michael's going to win in the Delaware case. And in my case, I have my fingers crossed and obviously hope that I'll win.
Oh, did I say Delaware? I meant to say Comcast. I'm sorry.
Oh, in terms of Comcast, I'm too experienced a lawyer to offer any prediction with regard to the court. It was a frustrating oral argument in the sense that this case is on a motion to dismiss at the very beginning of the lawsuit. And so what I wanted to talk about is what should be the standard to get into court to withstand a motion to dismiss. And the justice especially wanted to talk about what should be the standard for ultimately prevailing at trial. And it's always frustrating an argument where the lawyer wants to talk about one thing and the judges want to talk about something else.
And who was the most difficult justice to face and why? Wait, did I stump you? I've never stumped you.
That's how I want to answer that question. I'll answer it directly. I thought that Justice Gorsuch was the toughest justice. I think he was the only justice who was somewhat abrupt and sarcastic towards me at oral argument.
All right. Well, we appreciate
Michael's former colleague.
That's right.
That's right. We served together on the 10th Circuit.
And I just got back from Vail, Colorado 2 days ago, and everywhere is the Gorsuch stores in Vail. So Michael had a lot more intellectual connection than I did by just walking into the store. But that's just a tangent. Professor Chemerinsky, what's the most important case this year in 2 minutes or less?
I think the three cases concerning subpoenas of President Trump's financial records are, in terms of our Constitution, the most important cases. Because what President Trump is claiming is that he and those who he does business with are immune from subpoenas. He's saying he's immune even if it's about matters that occurred before he took office. The New York grand jury subpoena is about financial records as to whether he violated campaign laws with regard to the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and other women. And I think if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of President Trump here, basically saying that the president is above the law. And so in terms of separation of powers in the Constitution, I would put those at the top of the list.
Professor McConnell, interesting cases. Now, there's two aspects to those cases. One is what Professor Chemerinsky is talking about, the substance of it, and then there's the political issue. We have two Trump appointees now on the court, a 5-4 majority, which conservative majority, which most people would agree with. How does these cases come out when you have the 5-4? Is it a foregone conclusion?
Oh, of course not. I mean, I don't think that the five Republican appointees are any more party bound than the four Democratic appointees. I'm sure these people, will come to the cases with their own attitudes and ideologies, but I don't think these are foregone conclusions. I agree with Irwin that these are extremely important cases, but they're important either way they come out. Another way to put the case, Irwin is right in describing them in a sense, but another way to describe them is whether any state prosecutors, no matter how biased or political they may be, can haul presidents into court and be able to rifle through their private affairs almost without any limitation, or whether a single House of Congress can do that. I hope that there's some sort of middle ground, but the House and the New York Attorney General are both asserting authority to hail presidents into court and be able to rifle through their private matters in a way with no limitation whatsoever.
Interesting, because there seems to be a common thread here when Professor Chemerinsky was talking about the Comcast case and access to the courts, and you're talking about access to the courts now with the financial records. After the break, we're going to talk about the New York City gun rule, which has some of these issues, whether the court should be deciding a law that's been since repealed. Before we get to that, let's just get on to the bottom line. Rather than talking about the actual substance of the financial records, what's going to happen in your best prediction? First, Professor McConnell.
Oh, I'm like Irwin. I don't know about predictions. I do think that the cases raise somewhat different technical legal questions, because whether a New York attorney general is able to get this kind of access to the president's records raises federalism issues that are not present in the other. And the cases involving House committees instead are primarily separation of powers cases at the federal level.
Irwin, you don't agree with that, do you?
Well, I think Michael makes really important points. I think in terms of the New York case, what I would add is it's all about actions that occurred prior to Trump taking office. And in Clinton versus Jones, the Supreme Court unanimously said that a president doesn't have immunity for acts that occurred prior to taking office. I think Michael is absolutely right that the congressional cases involve a separation of powers issue between Congress and the president. But here, what I would add to what Michael said is these are matters that really go directly to Congress's ability to check the precedent and exercise oversight over the precedent. And I think here the most relevant Supreme Court case was United States versus Nixon in 1974, where the Supreme Court unanimously said that a president did have to comply with subpoenas, that even though there's executive privilege, the need for evidence at a criminal trial outweighs it. And obviously the context is different, but I think a broad immunity from all subpoenas is something the court's not going to want to go to.
You know, interesting.
Except that historically there's a lot of difference between subpoenas issued by grand juries in the course of criminal investigations and subpoenas issued by politically minded houses of Congress. There has never been a subpoena of this sort before.
Well, we'll see what happens. We have to take a break. It reminds me of when I was a young debater at Brown University, and one of my debates, after the debate, the judges said, "That was an awful debate. There was no clash. Where is the clash?" So far, you guys have just been so much on the same wavelengths, pretty much. After the break, we're going to look for some clash. We're going to go over these cases and see if there's some a little bit of maybe different thinking going on here. You're listening to Gervie's Law, and Carrie's going to say something.
No,
go
we
ahead.
Just need another one-liner. We got to get one.
That's
from
not clash. No, we're talking about the substance clash. We're going to be right back after this break. We're Gervie's Law, and this is Talk Radio 790 KBC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
It's a beautiful day.
Yes, it's a beautiful day, at least for now. The streets become very crowded tomorrow as the kids get back to school and everyone's back at work. So all of that nice here in LA, all of the nice commutes, that's history. But what's going to be really important in 2020? Supreme Court rulings on a number of important cases. And we're talking about some of those cases now. We have Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the Dean of Berkeley Law. He's been the Dean of Berkeley Law since July 1st, 2017, 13th Dean. And we're speaking with Professor Michael McConnell, just across the way at Stanford, Professor of Law and Director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center, former U.S. Circuit Judge. And we are going to turn our attention to one of Carrie's favorite subjects.
Yes.
And, you know, Carrie, I know you know a lot about this. We are going to talk about something we teased before the break, the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus the City of New York. This is complex. I want to have our experts, the preeminent constitutional law scholars, talk about not only the procedural issues, but the substantive issues. Is there a live controversy? Let's first start with Professor Chemerinsky and then Professor McConnell.
New York gives different kinds of gun permits. One kind is a premises permit.
What happened?
Did we lose him?
Premises permit. I guess that's not a good word here. Professor McConnell, you still there?
I am.
Oh. I've never asked for you to take over from Chemerinsky in the mid-sentence, but why don't you go and explain what the controversy is for this New York City gun rule?
So the problem here is that the premises permit does not allow, it's the only permit that the particular parties here were eligible to get, and it doesn't allow them to go to gun ranges or to take their transport their guns, you know, from one home to like a second home and so forth. So at this point, I think it's pretty well agreed that these restrictions are too severe to pass muster under the Second Amendment. And so the case is up, in the Supreme Court, and it's a city ordinance being challenged, almost certainly going to be held unconstitutional. And so the state passes a law basically overturning the city ordinance for the precise purpose of trying to get the Supreme Court to kick the case out so there won't be a precedent set. So what's really at stake today is...
And there they go.
Wait, he gone too?
Yeah, they're both
No,
gone.
I don't believe it.
Oh, wait.
Who's
I'm
there?
I'm now here.
Oh, you're back.
I was talking and then all of a sudden disconnected.
By the way, Professor Chemerinsky, Professor McConnell took over in mid-sentence as you were speaking, and he continued your train of thought. Never happened before.
Well, and I think I can do his because I heard the last few seconds.
Go ahead.
And so New York has repealed that ordinance. In fact, the New York State Legislature has adopted a law prohibiting such ordinances. And so what New York says to the Supreme Court is, this is moot. It's a challenge to a law that no longer exists. Supreme Court dismissed the case. And interestingly, the case was argued, I think, on December 2nd, and about 80% of the argument focused not on the Second Amendment, but on whether or not the case was moot.
Wow. And if we talked about the Second Amendment, you being a proponent of gun control, what are your thoughts on the actual law that was repealed?
I think that there is a majority on the Supreme Court that wants to expand the protections of the Second Amendment and to find that it's a right to have guns not just in the home for sake of security, but also outside the home. And there are so many questions that are left open by District of Columbia versus Heller. What should be the standard in evaluating laws regulating guns? When should the government be able to regulate guns outside the home? And I think some of the conservatives on the court really want to use this case as the basis for expanding gun rights. On the other hand, the law no longer exists, and moot cases are generally dismissed.
Professor McConnell, you're back. Why don't you close out this discussion of this case with your thoughts?
Well, I do think the only issue now is whether there continues to be a live case. I think it's a hard question, but the general principle is that defendants can't destroy a case by ceasing to do what they were doing. And so at this point, it's quite transparent that the state of New York is simply trying to avoid setting up a bad, what it will regard as a bad precedent. And I'm not sure that that's a basis for the court to dismiss the case.
Okay. Let's move on because we have a few more we want to get through. June Medical Services, LLC versus G. That's the Louisiana law requiring physicians who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. Conflict with Supreme Court precedent. That's the Whole Woman's Health and Hellerstedt case. Professor McConnell, what are your views on this case?
Well, I think it was very surprising that the court decided to hear this case because it really seems to turn on extremely small questions of factual difference between this case, which arises from Louisiana, and the Whole Woman's Health case from Texas. And ordinarily, the Supreme Court doesn't intervene to try to mop up, minor factual questions. If I understand the case correctly, maybe I don't, but the difference seems to be that in Texas, the requirement of getting admitting privileges was shown to be to block abortion doctors from being able to get it because of another practice in Texas where admitting privileges were only given to doctors with a certain volume of cases in the hospital, and that you can't say the same. There's no evidence of the same in Louisiana. Now, I would have thought that this is something to be resolved by the trial court, which is the district court, which found in favor of the abortion clinics. The Court of Appeals overturned that decision, which seems a little odd, and now it seems even odder that the Supreme Court would get involved in such an intensely factual question.
Now that Professor McConnell has denigrated this case, we only have 30 seconds. Professor Chemerinsky, do you agree this is a waste of time?
Well, but for the context, it's about abortion. The Supreme Court in Whole Woman's Health said there's no reason to believe that admitting privileges do anything to protect the health of women, and they ultimately close facilities. I think what's key is Whole Woman's Health had Justice Kennedy joining with Justices Ginsburg, Breyerson, and Kagan. He's no longer there, and it looks like there's 5 votes who are going to be much more willing to allow laws restricting abortion.
And that may lead to bigger changes to come. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have the rapid round. We're going to go through some cases really quickly in our last segment. We're talking to Professor Erwin Chemerinsky and Professor Michael McConnell, and you're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposures, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner. If you're suffering from a work-related injury, Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now, 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, giving you a new perspective to enrich your life. Now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
All right, we're back with a few sweet dreams from the Eurythmics. Not that this is a music show. It's a rundown of the 2020 Supreme Court cases. And we are speaking with Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of Berkeley Law, and Professor Michael McConnell of Stanford and the director of Stanford Constitutional Law Center at Stanford University. Okay, gentlemen, thank you so much for all of these really insightful comments on these cases. We're going into the rapid round. We only have 10 minutes, so we're going to go through a few cases here. Let's start with the dispute over the termination of DACA, the Deferred Action of Childhood Arrivals, three cases from California, D.C., New York. Professor McConnell, start us off quickly. What do you think?
So I think the Trump administration is very likely to win this case. I think the policies that they're promoting are quite distasteful. I don't like them. But this is a case where the prior administration simply announced a policy based upon its own prosecutorial discretion. It was uncertain whether they had the right to do that. It was either, illegal for the Obama administration to announce its policy, or if it was legal, it was a pure matter of discretion. So it seems to me that under either of those theories, the Trump administration should win. If it was illegal, they should win for that reason. If it wasn't illegal, then it's a matter of pure discretion, and this administration has just as much right to exercise discretion one way as the prior administration did to exercise it the other.
Professor Chemerinsky, why is this a Supreme Court case?
Well, I'm one of the co-counsel in this case. I'm involved since the district court level and disagree here with Michael. And what we got to emphasize is this is about 700,000 Dreamers, individuals who are brought to the United States under the age of 15 and whether they can stay in the country. The Supreme Court has said that there has to be a legitimate, articulated reason for an administrative action. And every court to rule on this, whether it was a judge appointed by a Democratic president or Republican president, has said that President Trump articulated no legitimate reason for rescinding DACA. And so I think if the Supreme Court follows its precedents, including its recent precedent in the census case, it's going to rule against the Trump administration.
So this isn't a political issue. It's actually a legal one.
Of course it's a legal issue. The question is, did President Trump articulate a legitimate reason for rescinding DACA? But it's a legal issue with enormous human consequences. It involves students who are at my law school, at Stanford Law School, on my campus and campus across the country, and the idea that we're going to put these individuals at risk of immediate deportation is cruel, but I also think it was an illegal decision by the president.
And do you think that the Supreme Court will uphold it and not shoot down the president's perspective?
I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court will follow what all the lower courts have said. On the other hand, in Trump versus Hawaii in June of 2018, the five conservative justices expressed a desire for great deference to the president in matters of immigration.
All right, Carrie, we're going to move on. You mentioned when we were between segments that you want to talk about the Zarda, Bostic, and Stevens cases.
You know what I talked about was the fact that I had something to say regarding certain cases, one of them, of course, being gun control or anything with guns, the abortion issue, and the LBG.
Yeah, and that those are the three cases. You didn't know the names of them.
No, I have them right here on my phone. I've been looking at them the entire time.
This was the cases that were heard in October, right? And the question was the federal employment for the LGBT employees. Professor Chemerinsky, what is your perspective?
Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act prohibits employment discrimination, quote, because of sex. It also prohibits discrimination based on race or religion. Two of the cases, Altitude Express versus Zarda and Bostic versus Clayton County, involve male employees who were fired when the employers learned they were gay. The other case, RG and GR Funeral Homes for Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, involves an individual who is fired for being transgender. The question is this discrimination because of sex? I think the answer to that should be clear, and I'll give you a simple example to show why. Think of an employee named Chris. Chris has never met in person the employer. They talk by email and text. Chris is often referred to a husband in discussing weekend or vacation plans. When the employer finally meets Chris in person, the employer is shocked to discover that Chris is male and fires Chris for being gay. If Chris were female, Chris would still have that job. Chris was fired entirely because of sex. And so taking the literal language of Title VII, which the conservatives say is key, I think that it should be clear who should win these cases.
What about you, Professor McConnell?
Well, I think these are hard cases, and I really have no idea how the Supreme Court is going to decide them. The funeral home case is, the hardest for the plaintiff because the person was not fired for being a trans person, but rather for violating the dress code in a funeral home. The odd thing here is, of course, that sex-specific dress codes are obviously discriminatory on the basis of sex, but are also permitted. And so this is an area of the law in which a certain amount of discrimination on the basis of sex is already permitted. And so I think the basic textual argument that Irwin just made doesn't get you across the finish line.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. Two more cases really quickly in the next 2 minutes. The Montana case, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. Can government exclude religious schools or groups from governmental benefits? Are these essentially religious endeavors? Professor McConnell?
Well, I agree with the legal principle that a state can't exclude an otherwise eligible institution merely because of its religious affiliation, but I don't really think that's what the case is about. The Montana Supreme Court held that this is a case about tax benefits for schools, and the court held that because the provision properly constitutionally interpreted would include religious schools, it was simply going to deny the benefit to all schools. So currently in Montana, no private schools, whether religious or not, are eligible for this benefit. That, I think, does not violate the principle against discrimination.
All right. We only have a minute. Professor Chemerinsky, last one, ministerial exemption. This is confusing to me. How do you define minister for the purposes of civil rights protections, and why aren't these people bound by civil rights?
The Supreme Court many terms ago said that there cannot be a claim for under discrimination law against a religious institution for choices it makes as to who will be its ministers. Interestingly, that case involved a fifth-grade teacher who had become ordained as a minister in that religion. And the Supreme Court denied unanimously the ability of that person to sue under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But that then raises the question of how do you define who's clergy for purpose of this exception? I think it's an enormously difficult question, and these are a couple of very significant cases about it.
Okay. Last thing, Google versus Oracle. Is that worth talking about, or should we do that on another show?
Wait, I think we have to do it on another show.
Professor McConnell, Professor Chemerinsky, what's the answer? Is that an important case, Google versus Oracle?
It's the most important case other than the Delaware case.
Oh, no. You can't tell me that.
We missed it.
At the end of the hour, I blew it again. Professor Chemerinsky, Professor McConnell, this has been really wonderful having you discuss these cases. We'll have to have you back on halfway through to find out what happens and talk about the Google versus Oracle. And if you don't know about that case, Google it because you need to learn about it. Thanks so much for being with us today, both Irwin and Michael.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.